Loose and physical, okay? Because it's at the end of the class, it's the end of the time at the end of the class. I'm feeling a little burnt out, but also I don't want to load you down with a lot of technicality. So I'm going to talk physics, because the physics is very simple. The realization of these ideas can be pretty sophisticated mathematically, but I think I better not touch that. I'll point you in the directions of where the math goes. So what is the symmetry of the ground state for a theory of quantum gravity like this? And there are two worrying, very worrying issues, questions, which came up and which people should have been sensitive to a long time ago. Let me get another blackboard here.
What is the definition?
Well, so first of all,
when you don't have fault state.
Good point. Okay, good point. So here's one thing you should need. Okay? Let's try to stay close to classical general relativity and ask what we mean in the case of classical general relativity. In the case of classical general relativity, we can impose boundary conditions on a sphere. So in space-time, on a three-sphere, I'm sorry, on a two-sphere in space, or on a three-sphere, on a two-sphere, sorry, across time and space-time. And we can choose a boundary in space-time, which is a two-sphere across time, so a cylinder. And we can put boundary conditions on the cylinder of some particular kind. And I discussed in one of the classes the possible choices of boundary conditions. Here it doesn't matter much. The important thing is that there is then a time coordinate on the boundary, because the gauge invariance reduces at the boundary. There is then a Hamiltonian, which is an integral over n times the Hamiltonian constraint, plus an integral, say this is on the spatial manifold sigma, plus an integral on the boundary of n at the boundary times an object I'll call little h, which is a boundary term. And we know what little h should be in different choices of boundary conditions. Now, in classical GR, there are several ways to say this. One way is that there is an observable, which is the area of the boundary. And we can take the area of the boundary to infinity. And we can define asymptotically flat boundary conditions. I think I discussed this once. Okay. And then the Hamiltonian is what's called the ADM Hamiltonian. There are several different ways of writing it. And I think I showed that before, so let me just give the ideas here. Okay. And it's a theorem in classical general relativity that this is positive definite. So this is a theorem by Schoen and Yao, and a much more beautiful at least to me, transparent proof by Whitman, that this is positive definite, and HADM equals zero is if and only if flat space-time. Okay, so that's what we know classically. Okay. That suggests quantum mechanically, we can conjecture A, there exists some operator, which is the quantization of this classical thing, that H medium is positive definite on physical states, that is states in the kernel of the Hamiltonian constraint and the diffeomorphism constraints appropriately defined respecting the boundary conditions. Okay. And there's a unique state, which I'll call G for ground state, that it annihilates, which is the unique lowest energy state. Let me emphasize that we do not have such results in loop quantum gravity or for any other background independent approach to quantum gravity that I know of. And that's a serious problem. That's a very serious problem. And it's an issue that people should work on, in my opinion. We have some work in progress with Artem Strabotsky, and we can sort of get some formal results, but we're really unable to show that the operator that we identify exists. So this is an important open problem. If the problem were solved, then this would be the definition of the ground state.
Is that a reason for thinking about that there should be a unique solution to the ground state?
Supposing that there wasn't, then it would mean that there was structure in space-time which had zero energy. Okay, so that would be bad. That would probably disagree with the experiment. Because if it was a little bit of ambiguity, supposing it was one parameter ambiguity, okay, maybe it would be a CP violating phase or something like that. Okay. If it was a lot of ambiguity, it would just feel it would be bad. And this is a worry. This is a place that all these kinds of theories could fail, could easily fail.
If you were to construct a state based on Minkowski space and ask the question, what is the energy of that state?
Yes. Well, you could fake it. There's a lot of things you can fake, including something along the lines of what you just said. But it's not. Let me put it this way. Okay. Here's a result. Here's a worrying classical result. We know that in the Ashtakar formulation, the constraints are polynomial. So that means there are solutions. So there are solutions to the Ashtakar constraints that we had before, such that we have this electric field. This is what the metric is made of. This is a 3x3 matrix. So its determinant can be zero. And if its determinant is zero, then you can form the densitized 3 metric, which is EAI BBI. But you can't invert it to find the metric. It just has the inverse metric. Okay, so there are lots of solutions to the constraints where the determinant of the metric is not zero, which raises a question. And Stanley Desert, in a paper a few weeks ago, addressed this question with my advisor back when I was a student. Why is the determinant of the metric not zero? Because there are classical solutions which are. Not only that, the classical result requires the determinant of the metric downstairs to be not zero. And conversely, it's not at all difficult to find solutions of the following form. They look like the Schwarzschild solution outside some radius, but with negative mass, then they have a region where the metric is degenerate and has no determinant. I don't know what that, oh, that's because I have the BlackBerry near the microphone. And then they have flat space on the inside. And so that's bad. In other words, one can make find classical solutions in this formalism where the positive energy theorem is violated. Because the positive energy theorem requires the determinant of the metric being not zero. So it's worrying. It's worrying. And it's a vulnerable point. And it's also frustrating because if we had such an operator, then finding the ground state would be a simple case of minimizing it. And then we could just use all the standard techniques, whether variational techniques, approximation techniques, to try to find the best ansatz for the ground state, and then ask the question of whether symmetry is.
Can I ask a related question? Once you brought up the Grignard shell determinant being allowable to be zero, the signature of the metric, is that, could that be also considered an emergent thing in the sense that if you go off shell, perhaps the signature is not, it can change to some other space time relationship? Or is
sure, in principle, sure. Now, in a formalism where the frame field is a fundamental variable, it's hard to get the spatial signature to change sign.
Right.
But, I mean, in principle, sure.
In principle, you can have all four spatial. It'd be easier.
Yeah. I mean, the existence of these questions strongly suggests that we're not working at the most fundamental level we can.
I was wondering if the signature was hard coded into this.
Yes, it is, but that doesn't mean that up to this, the signature is hard-coded into this, but it doesn't mean that, but that's because choices are made, which code it in.
Through the choice of the manifold being R across some state.
Through the choice that here I tie these things up with a positive Euclidean three-dimensional metric.
So it's R across sigma.
Yeah.
So we have a spatial manifold, then we cross R.
Yeah. But I mean, if I drop this, then I could make something interesting. Do we have enough? Okay, but you know, these are all good questions. So that's what the ground state should be. There are path integral definitions of the ground state. The ground state is the wave function with no nodes, and it's the wave function with maximal symmetry. There are various definitions of the ground state that might be useful. Okay. In any case, whatever definition you have, the reason why it's an interesting question for physics is that classically, look, the role of Poincaré invariance is it's not a symmetry of general relativity, it's a symmetry of a solution to the equations of general relativity, which happens to be the distinguished lowest energy solution. So one can ask analogously, if one would have a distinguished ground state for the quantum theory, what would be its symmetry? And its symmetry might be the same as the classical one, but it might not be the same as the classical one. And it's an interesting question because it's experimentally accessible, what the symmetry is.
Did you say that the ground state from spin films is a zero volume universe with no nodes?
I did not say that, no.
Well, I interpreted if you have no nodes, then the
volume. Oh, I meant nodes are the wave function. In the ground state of a simple system like the Hermann Hertz wave, sorry. Okay, so that's the issue. I know of, well, and then there's the following paradox about the symmetry of the ground state, which is the following. So if you believe that L Planck is a minimal length, which, or, I mean, there are many ways to say this, or L Planck cubed is a minimal volume, will work just as well. Then, which is a result in loop quantum gravity at the kinematical level and the spatially diffeomorphism invariant level, then what, how does that affect the question of what the symmetry of the ground state is? Well, supposing that there's a ground state, and supposing that you probe it with various excitations, and you reveal evidence, you're an observer, you make some measuring instruments, you scatter things, and you probe the fact that there's a shortest length, you maybe begin to start seeing discreteness in quantum geometry when you measure things below that length. Then, but you're in the ground state, so somebody is moving with respect to you. If there's a principle of inertia in the ground, if there's not a principle of inertia in the ground state, it's not the physics we know. If there's a principle of inertia in the ground state, then we expect that there's be a relativity of inertial frames. So somebody else can be making the same experiments, moving an inertial observer with respect to you, and they should also agree that there's a smallest length, if it's physically meaningful. And then the issue is their smallest length length contracted with respect to my smallest length? Because usually lengths are contracted under the Poincaré group. So the notion that there is a minimal length, okay, so let me just spell this out. If there's a minimal length and it's observer independent, so all observers agree on what the minimal length is, then there apparently is a contradiction with Lorentz invariance. Because what if I should see the observer's minimal length, if the observer is moving with respect to me, to be length contracted, and therefore to be shorter than my minimal length. So that's a kind of paradox. And there are three answers. One of them is, in any case, there's Poincaré invariance anyway. And roughly speaking, that's the resolution of the problem that works in perturbative string theory. And that is a very interesting non-trivial argument for string theory, the fact that it resolves the paradox and lets you have ordinary Lorentz invariance. And I can say something about how string theory resolves it. Another point of view is just Lorentz invariance is broken. Which means that there's a preferred frame. And that is actually the answer that a lot of people got with kind of naive calculations in loop quantum gravity. So if you just take a very naive semi-classical state in which you just diagonalize the area in the volume operator, and you just take, say, a weave state. So just take a state which is just some lattice, you know, with spacing L Planck, with respect to some background metric Q0 AB. Okay, so that can be a state of loop quantum gravity. You can arrange the labels on the edges and the nodes such as you reproduce measurements of areas and volumes and so forth of surfaces and regions. So you can just make a state, roughly speaking. I mean, you can do fancier things, but this is good enough. And you can be clever and arrange it to be a solution of everything that you want it to be.
So a weave state is an eigenstate of the volume and
for every possible large enough region, where they match the measurements, where the expectation values of the eigenvalues in the state match the measurements made in the metric in that region. Yeah. And people have been playing with these since 86, 87. And if you couple the theory to matter and you study the dynamics of the matter degrees of freedom, or if you study gravitons, you can even make operators that create and annihilate gravitons and make a kind of Fock space of them, then there's no excitation smaller than the lattice spacing. So basically, you can sort of transfer a lot of results from lattice gauge theory into loop quantum gravity. And you're just in a frame of reference of the lattice. And so, for example, when people compute energy-momentum relations, which they very laboriously did by coupling the theory to matter and doing a semi-classical expansion around the state, they found that E squared is P squared plus some coefficient L Planck EQ plus some other coefficient beta L Planck squared E to the fourth plus et cetera. So they get deformed energy-momentum relations. And a number of people did this work. And they conclude that there's no Lorentz invariance. For example, the speed of light, which is del E del P, is 1 plus alpha L prime P. I have the signs right, maybe plus 2. I'm not sure. Don't trust me with that. Okay. Plus, et cetera. So there's an energy-dependent speed of light. It turns out that actually you get here a plus a something times the helicity. So you get plus or minus depending on whether the helicity is left-handed or right-handed. This was, for example, work with Gambini in Poland. And there's a preferred frame of reference. Lorentz invariance is violated, and the symmetry of the ground state is just the Euclidean group. And there are big experimental implications because there's an energy-dependent speed of light. There are implications for scattering experiments, for conservation laws, because the relationship between energy and momentum has these higher order terms. And this is a possibility that has been pretty thoroughly explored in the literature in about the last 10 years. And this conclusion is that if the ground state is one of these weave states or something like it, then Lorentz invariance is broken. And there are a lot of predictions. So that's a possible answer. And any questions about that? I mean, if people want this literature about it. Yeah?
Well, just, I mean, is it anywhere in the observable range?
I mean,
present the observable
range? Sure. In fact, it's mostly ruled out already.
Okay. And then the second question, could it, I mean, that's a bullshit question, but could it be related to the varying alpha prime?
Varying alpha? That's been speculated about. Yes, that's been speculated about.
And it has been speculated as a little
bit. I've not seen anything convincing. Let me tell you the experiment that most rules this out. And there's a big literature about it. The experiment that most strongly, that puts the strongest limits on alpha for photons is surprising. And what it is, and it has to do with the fact that there's a helicity dependence. And let me just say where that comes from. From the point of view of effective field theory, I'm running out of space here. Let me just keep going. So the point, if Lorentz invariance is just broken, you should use effective field theory to compute what you expect to see. And so the Hamiltonian for Maxwell is a half B squared plus b squared. And the simplest thing that you can get at the next order is, what I want to say, 1 over m Planck times epsilon abc dA del d bc. Yeah, I think that's right. And this is parity odd. And this results in an energy momentum relation, which is this here with alpha being helicity dependent, because this is parity odd. So you get a plus sign for, you get one sign for left-handed photons, another sign for right-handed photons. What that means is that planes of polarizations rotate. So one helicity is going slightly faster than the other helicity. And it means that as they travel, planes of polarizations rotate. And it means, and they rotate at a frequency or an energy dependent rate. So if you look in a regime of frequency, the whole, a polarization signal can get washed out. That is, if you're only able to look in frequency this narrow, and you're looking at an object which started off playing polarized far enough away, it should completely have washed out by then. And one can use the fact that there are observations of polarized radio galaxies from some distance away, I don't remember the numerical numbers, to rule this out at an alpha, which is, I think, like 10 to the minus 6 or 7 or something like that. I don't remember precisely, but it's really strongly suppressed.
Is there any way to restore the usual form by putting in counter terms like we do in renormalization?
But the philosophy of effective field theory is if the symmetry is broken, you expect just, these are not fundamental terms in Lagrangian, these are just low energy effective terms. And you expect to just have everything that the remaining symmetry allows. And that's the leading thing that the remaining symmetry allows. So, and there's a number, there's a whole literature on this. There are a number of other experiments. And it's possible that for some reason there's no order L Planck effect, and the effects are order L Planck squared, in which case broken Lorentz symmetry is still plausible, I'm told. But it looked at, for order L Planck breaking of Lorentz invariance, there's a problem. And then there are also other people who argue that it's actually much worse than that, because once you break Lorentz invariance, it's going to feed into other lower dimensional terms, and you're going to have things like mass kind of terms that are, depend on the frame of reference that you're in and stuff like that. So you could get really stuff that sort of order one disagrees with observation. Yeah?
Sorry, just another question. You said that preserving from collision invariance in some ways still leads to perturbative symmetry. Is that a unique statement, or is it, I mean,
so far as I know,
the string theory, is there a theorem string theory is the only way to
do it? No. So there's not a theorem that string theory is the only way to do it. And there's not a theorem either that this is the only realization of string theory.
Okay.
But ordinary string theory in flat space-time cross any constant compactification is Poincaré invariant, at least to the order that the perturbation theory is defined, to genus 2 or whatever it is, where it's defined. And there's some very nice papers of Suskind and collaborators where they discuss what's called the string bit picture, which was actually invented by one of the very, very early string theorists whose name I'm forgetting. And it's a very, very pretty picture. Basically, the idea is that a string is made of a certain number of units of bits of longitudinal momentum. And when you boost a string, so you see it from the point of view of different observers, you increase the number of bits of longitudinal, of quantum longitudinal momentum the string is carrying. But they get stretched out in the transverse plane. So that as you boost a string, it's not a point-like object. It's basically, you should see it as sort of a little game of links If this is sort of the longitudinal direction coming at you, so this is the transverse direction of the plane, a string consists of a bunch of little links, each of which carries a particular quanta of longitude momentum related to the string scale. And if you boost it, it carries more links. And the links go out, sort of go out in a random walk. So you don't have behavior under the Lorentz transformation of a local object. The transformation is complicated, but it all works out to preserve quantum invariance. And it's very beautiful. And it was that understanding that made me personally, when I realized that these loop quantum gravity calculations were leading to Lorentz invariances breaking, and in string theory they resolved the paradox, that was the thing that made me work on string theory for about 3 years.
But isn't there a third option?
Yes, I'm coming to the third option.
Well, that you don't have a time scale, and that gravity is just an effect of theory?
There is such a, so that's a fourth option. That's a fourth option. But let me tell you about the third option. So the third option, which is DSR, has a long checkered history, but from the point of view of how we usually teach special relativity, I can state it precisely in a series of postulates, and I think that this is, if the computer is still working. So these are various things that I've said. Okay, so these are the principles. So we have a relativity of inertial frame. We have the constancy of a velocity. We have a constancy of an energy, so all observers agree. The energy Ep is just h bar over the Planck length, or h bar c, wherever the c is, go over the Planck length. And then the fourth one, the third one is different, because usually in special relativity there's no constancy, there's no preservation of an energy or length. And the fourth postulate says that c, which is the universe velocity, is only the universal speed of photons in the limit of e less than ep. So all that's required, in other words, is that the speed of a photon, as seen by an observer who measures it to have energy e, is c plus order e over ep. And that's all that's required by these postulates. So these postulates define what's called deformed or doubly special relativity. And so if you can realize these postulates, you can realize a physics in which there is a shortest length scale, which is universal, and in which there's still also a relativity of inertial frames.
I think there are no Planck energy photons in the universe that we can detect.
The highest energy cosmic rays which have been detected are about a billionth of the Planck energy. And I think for photons it's somewhat less than that, but I don't know. Okay. And so this is what's called VSR. This has a checkered history in that it was known that this is possible to Fock, and it's in fact a problem in a relativity book that Fock wrote in the 1950s. It was known that this was a possibility to Snyder. If you know the famous Oppenheimer-Snyder papers about collapse, gravitational collapse to a black hole, which I think were from the 1940s, Snyder also in the 1950s realized this. And in fact, he realized this in a version of non-commutative geometry, which was the first version of non-commutative geometry ever invented. But those things were forgotten, apparently forgotten. It was discovered how to realize this. Maybe I should be writing down. So Fock, Snyder. So these are both in the 1950s. And it may be that it goes further back than that, but Lukerski and collaborators in the 90s, coming through the route of non-commutative geometry, invented a form of non-commutative geometry that satisfies this, which is called, as did Sean Majeed. And I've heard different things about who was first, but that's not, let me not put my foot in that. So this is in the 1990s, in the context of what's now called, or maybe it was called then, Kaplan and Minkowski space-time, also sometimes called Kappa Poincaré symmetry. So basically what they discovered is that there is a deformation of the Poincaré algebra which preserves a scale, so that you can enlarge, but you can change, modify the Poincaré algebra in such a way that it preserves the scale. And they found that that algebra is the symmetry algebra of a certain non-commutative geometry called Kaplan-Minkowski space-time. And then Giovanni Annolino Camelia, in about 2000, formulated as a physical idea DSR. In other words, from the point of view of these postulates or these kind of postulates. So this is sort of the physical idea. And then Zhao and I, a little bit later, came to a very similar idea. And at that point, it got a little bit more attention. And we learned some things about it. So that's the history of the subject. Now, maybe what I'll do is sort of tell you roughly what the main ideas and the main directions are, without loading you down with a lot of mathematics. So for example, I'm not going to write this algebra down. One of the reasons I'm not going to write it down is it comes in a number of different presentations. Since it's a nonlinear algebra, it's not a Lie algebra, it's a nonlinear algebra, and there are many, many ways to present it. And I think it's mostly confusing because the physical ideas are pretty clear. Okay, so
this question.
Yeah.
This default special relativity is only a symmetry which the ground state should have of gravity. It's not a symmetry of gravity itself, right?
Well, that's the point of view I'm taking. Somebody might take a different point of view. Let me tell you, without telling you the details, one way to think about it, which might help answer your question, which was actually the original way that Lukerski and collaborators came upon. So there is the notion of the quantum deformation of a Lie algebra. And particularly you can take the quantum deformation of, say, the de Sitter algebra. So the de Sitter algebra is, I always forget which is 2, 3, and which is 1, 4. I don't remember. Between de Sitter and anti-de Sitter.
De Sitter is 1, 4.
Okay. It actually doesn't matter which one I think, but okay. Quantum deformed. So there is this argument related to the quantum deformation of the Chern-Simon, related to the Chern-Simons theory and the Chern-Simon state, that if you have quantum gravity with a cosmological constant, that the asymptotic symmetry should not be the de Sitter group or the anti-de Sitter group, but it's quantum deformation. And let me not, that's related to the ideas about the role of Chern-Simon theory in the semi-classical state, but let me not try to justify that. And the particular relation is that the log of q, let me just write q. Q equals e to the 2 pi I over k plus 2, where k is 6 pi over the cosmological constant and dimensionless units. Okay. Now, you're probably familiar with the idea of contraction. So let me remind you, the idea of contraction is that if I take, so let me say that M, that these are the generators of SO14. Let me call them M capital AB, where A goes over the indices A and 5, and A is 0, 1, 2, and 3. Okay? So we have a fifth dimension that we're doing rotations into. And one can think of the 5A generators as like energy momentum generators. But because these are dimensionless, because they generate a rotation group or Lorentz group, and momentum and energy are not dimensionless, one should have a scale here. And the scale here should be related to the cosmological constant. So one can put here square root of the cosmological constant, because the cosmological constant is 1 over length squared. Let me put the square root of lambda here. Okay. So if then one considers the limit of lambda goes to 0, the lambda is 1 over r squared. So r, which is like the radius of the universe, goes to infinity, then SO14 goes to the Poincaré algebra, where we identify this as the momentum generators in the Poincaré algebra. And particularly, the important thing is that M5A, M5B, just from the commutator, is MAB. So this tells us that PA, PB goes, and if I do the scaling right, like 1 over r squared times the rotation generator MAB, and that goes to 0 as r goes to infinity. That's the way the contraction usually works. Okay, is everybody roughly familiar with that? Okay. So an interesting question is, if you start with the quantum group, there's the cosmological constant is sitting in kappa. And so is another scale, because what's really sitting here is r squared over the Planckian squared, because this constant is the Planckian squared, and the cosmological constant is 1 over the radius of the universe squared. So in other words, Q is dimensionless. And Q has in it a ratio of the radius of the universe and the Planck scale. And I'm not writing the algebra out for this quantum group, but it's a complicated nonlinear algebra. And the interesting observation is, if you take the contraction, then, and you tune, you take Q to 1. So as r goes to infinity, k goes to infinity, so Q goes to 1. But there's some terms that get trapped, and you don't get the Poincaré algebra. You get the Poincaré algebra corrected by some terms that have L Planck in them. So it remembers this scale here. R goes to infinity, but it remembers this scale here. Sorry. Can you see what I'm... Yeah. So, and this was the way that, to my understanding, this is the way that Lukerski and collaborators first discovered this algebra of kappa Poincaré symmetry, by starting with the quantum group and taking the contraction.
So is the limit of r going to infinity, you're losing one spatial dimension, so that when you get to Poincaré space, you're in 3 plus 1?
Yes. So this is one way to think about where it comes from.
Doesn't that create other problems? I mean, assuming you have a fourth dimension.
Well,
I mean, I just see, you know,
This is a, I mean, this is a formal fifth dimension. This is a, this is not saying that we have a fifth dimensional manifold or fifth dimensional spacetime. I'm just noting that the De Sitter group can be seen as a higher dimensional rotation group, and that's all I'm doing. There are attempts to interpret, one of the stories about DSR is that it goes as follows. This is a story that is to some extent fleshed out formally and to some extent not. A version of the story, the one that I think is the most powerful, is due to Tara and Florian, Tara Levine and Florian Girelli. And the story they tell goes roughly like the following. They say, in a quantum gravity theory, if you're an observer in the ground state, you're an inertial observer, assume they're inertial observers. So inertial observers are distinguished by their positions relative to each other and their time measurements. So they have positions and they have clocks and they have velocity. But they make quantum gravity measurements, which means that they also have a notion of a scale. So actually, there's a five-dimensional family of reference frames given by where they are and what scale they measure. And so you should really look for an invariance group amongst observers where you can also change the scale which you're making observations. But you should make all of that work in such a way that there's a smaller scale. So everybody agrees that there's a smaller scale, and everybody is talking about scale and ratio of the scale they're measuring to the smaller scale.
So how would an inertial observer be aware of the scale? They're just traveling along the unit.
They have a particle detector which is only able to detect particles up to a certain energy, for example. Okay. And then you develop those ideas and you end up with a version of DSR. And so, and it's interesting that that suggests that it's useful to think about an extra dimension in some macroscopic sense, which is a scale. A related idea, while I'm just talking ideas, which is the idea that we developed, with Zhao, is that the metric of space carries with it actually a scale dependence. So our idea is that if you're measuring geometry by some photon, you measure a metric by measuring, by making various measurements. And you should note sort of what's the frequency in your reference frame of the that you're using to make measurements of the geometry of space-time. And so that, and a natural way to justify this is that if you think from an effective field theory point of view, you have some effective Hamiltonian, and it's energy dependent, and coupling constants are energy dependent, and the metric just comes in. So I mean, if the effective Hamiltonian, which is a function of scale, has terms like QAB, EAEB, so the electric field squared, then really there should be an energy dependence, of which is the scale you're probing, because this is just a coupling constant. So you can heuristically argue to the idea that there should be an energy dependence in the notion of the metric, which should, that is, if you measure the metric at different scales, you should be able to get a different geometry. And there should be a symmetry group which relates these measurements to each other, which preserves the notion that there's a scale, that there's a fixed scale. And that's another route. So this is called the idea of a rainbow geometry. And that's been developed to some extent. And one of the important open questions is the relationship of this to the non-commutative geometry point of view. And an easy conjecture to make, but a hard one to demonstrate, is that they're equivalent to each other. Although a number of people I know believe that conjecture. So that would be a good thing to investigate as well. That this is somehow equivalent to a non-geometry. And the literature somewhat splits, I don't want to go on for too much longer. Let me just mention some high points of the literature here. So there's a bunch of papers having to do with 2 plus 1 gravity and DSR. And roughly speaking, the situation here is, and this is 2 plus 1 gravity plus matter, is that people doing calculations in 2 plus 1 gravity many years ago discovered phenomena like there's a deformed energy-momentum relation, EP relation. So this is what I'm referring to here, that the relationship between energy and momentum becomes modified. And also that there's deformed conservation laws. So for example, if you have a system which combines two particles, the energy of the system is not just the sum of the energies of those two particles. The momentum of the solar system is not just the momentum of the sum of the momentum of the two particles. Very, very analogously to the fact that when you go from ordinary physics to special relativity, all of a sudden velocity does not become additive anymore. There are nonlinear terms in adding velocity which guarantee that there is a maximum velocity. Similarly, there are modifications to how you can't just add a bunch of particles of energy E together and get N times E if there are N particles, because you can't exceed some bound, which is the upper limit to the energy. And so there are deformed conservation laws. And indeed, Q-deformed symmetry when the cosmological constant was turned on. And so there was a beautiful story taking place at 2 plus 1 gravity, which fit exactly into DSR, but nobody had noticed, because these realizations preceded the realization that there was a phenomenon called DSR. So then there is the realization that 2 plus 1 gravity with matter is DSR, that it provides an example of doubly special relativity. And there were some papers arguing for that, and that was clinched by this recent work of Batera and Laurent, who really showed that the low energy effective theory for 2 plus 1 gravity with matter has Kappa Poincaré symmetry, precisely. So if the world were 2 plus 1 dimensional, we would know that the world would. We would at least have a firm prediction that the world is DSR. So that tells us that the theory has a real realization, that if there are real physical systems that realize those postulates and they seem to make consistent sense. For 3 plus 1, there are some semi-classical arguments, but nothing that you would call a strong argument or a proof, because the argument makes assumptions. So there is a semi-classical argument, but and then there is literature both in the non-commutative geometry and the rainbow geometry versions of what a field theory that's invariant in a DSR might be. And so there's interesting developments about that. And then finally, there's phenomenology, both for sort of possibility of measuring an energy-dependent speed of light, This, by the way, the whole original idea, I forgot to say, that the whole original motivation for Zhao and my work was to try to make sense of Zhao's idea that the speed of light might be much faster in the very early universe. And this does make sense of it, because what happens is that as the energy approaches the maximum possible energy, the speed of light goes to infinity. So if you imagine the universe starting very near the quantum temperature, the speed of light could be arbitrarily high. So there's a literature about that. And then there's also very interesting literature connected to the large extra dimension idea that says that the Planck mass is about 10 TeV, if the large extra dimensions ideas are right. And Sabina Hassenfelder has worked out the possible phenomenology for the LHC. And this Schmidt's prediction for LHC experiments of various kinds. Okay. So there's a lot of work about DSR. The main hypothesis is still unshown, and for me, the main hypothesis is that it's the description of the ground state of the world in quantum gravity in 3+1 dimensions. So that remains, for me, the most important thing to do about this. The second most important thing, I would say, is really to, there's a kind of model, so this is sort of DSR quantum field theory. A number of people have worked on that, including Jean Maguejo and students, Giovanni and Ilino Canario and students. Here, Thomas Canopa has worked on it. A number of people have worked on it. And I think that the situation is confused, you know, whether there is really a sensible 3+1 dimensional interacting quantum field theory with this symmetry. So that's an open issue. OK, question?
What is when you have a maximum energy scale and you go to macroscopic objects, like when
yes.
so many atoms together, so do you get in trouble?
So that's called the soccer ball problem.
What is it?
The soccer ball problem.
Oh, okay.
You know, what if I kick a soccer ball, you know? Yes, so several comments. One, that's just the way the world is in 2+1 dimensions. In 2+1 dimensions, there just is a maximum mass, period. And the reason is that mass is a defect angle in 2+1 dimensions and is a maximum defect angle. So it's really just about making that consistent with some version of relativity of observers. There are several proposed resolutions of the Sankar-Bohr problem 3+1. The most natural one is that the maximum energy for a system of n elementary particles is n times the Planck energy. And that's consistent with what we know. It's not difficult to invent versions of the DSR kinematics in which that's true. And we did with Zhao, I think, in our second paper on the subject. What's interesting about that is that it requires you to do something that ordinary special relativity does not require you to do, which is that each body that you're transforming relativistically now has a number in it, which is the number of elementary particles that make it up. And you transform this piece of chalk differently than you transform the quarks and the electrons inside the piece of chalk. And the fact that you can do that consistently is something that you have to think about. But it seems like you can do that consistently, although it's subtle. And it does seem like you can. And some of the issue about a DSR quantum field theory is exactly how you do that. So the way that I would put it is there's a proposed solution to the problem. The problem is not solved, the theory is not relevant to physics. There's a proposal about the solution. There's some evidence that it can be worked through consistently. But since we have no detailed example of an interacting 3 plus 1 dimensional DSR quantum field theory, to my knowledge, it's an open question. Also a good problem to look at. Okay, any other questions? Okay, so let's stop and thank you.